I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
The only sensible reaction is mind-boggling wonder.
You do need to carve out times when you really aren't being productive at all.
We're sort of inside of a story that we didn't know about.
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
I have the work ethic of a comedian. 1 hour a day and you're good. But there have been times in the last few years when I've been very busy. Hosting, writing, touring, teaching. And don't get me wrong, I've loved it all, but I have had a whiff of what burnout could feel like. And that's where our columnist Brian Francis comes in. He's a man who knows his way around an advice book. And he opens today's program to recommend three books that celebrate the fine art of doing nothing. April, along with being notorious for those showers, is Poetry Month, a tradition in this country since 1998. In a half hour, our contributor Ryan B. Patrick speaks with the poet Dawn McDonald about her new collection, Northerny. It's a fresh take on what it means to grow up and live in the North. And bookseller and science lover Nathan Maharaj will be here to tell us about three books on popular science that he couldn't put down. I'm Ali Hassan. Welcome to the next chapter. Hustle culture, rise and grind. Thank God it's Monday. The work hard and optimize your time ethos is baked into many of our lives. Being busy is seen as a good thing, even a status symbol, and lots of free time can be a bit unnerving. Well, to help us relieve some of the pressure, even if it's self-imposed, our columnist Brian Francis is here with some book suggestions on slowing down and shifting perspective. Hi, Brian. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on.
So I know you juggle a number of things, your work, your writing career, not to mention crafting,
yes,
which you've talked about here, and yeah, your blog.
Yeah.
It's a pretty full plate. Where do you fit in on the hustle culture scale?
I think I fall victim to the thinking that a lot of us fall victim to, which is you have to be productive at all times. And when you're not being productive, you're not being valuable. You're not, you know, that sense of importance. If I'm busy, I must be important. But you do need to carve out times when you really aren't being productive at all. Like you're going for a walk and you don't know the destination, or you're, you know, setting off on something where there's no end goal in sight. You're just being mindful of your time. So, but it's totally difficult. It's a challenge. It's never easy for anybody, for sure.
Well, you know, I completely relate to this. This desire, this conflict of like, if you're not productive, you feel, and this is very cliched, but I do blame my mother, who would wake me up at 9:05 and be like, "You've wasted half the day," and then somewhere, you know, resenting that always, it just became in my mind, it became like, "Oh, I guess I have wasted half the day."
Yeah,
I want to ask you about sort of what kind of attitude you grew up with, especially about work.
Well, I started my career as a paper boy, so hard work was in me at a very
right
young
away.
Age. You had to deliver the papers on time, 6 days a week. You had to carry around that burlap sack in the heat of the summer. I had a little change belt that I would carry with me because when I would do the collecting. So it taught me responsibility, efficiency, punctuality. Having said that, though, I grew up with like a family where it was important for me to get a job, but it was mainly about also money. And that was the big thing when I was a teenager, is you wanted your own income. You wanted to get away from having to rely on mom and dad or the allowance, you know, that you would get. So when I got a job, like I think it was in my second year of high school, and never sort of looked back. But it's been a long road when you look back at all the jobs and opportunities that you've had over the years.
Sure. A good work ethic versus overwork. Right. Sometimes it is hard to draw that line. So tell me, what is the first book on your list?
So the first book is called Solitude by Michael Harris. He's the author of three books, including All We Want, Solitude, and The End of Absence. So his book is really in response to our obsessions with connection through our social devices and through like social media. We're connected more so than ever before, but those connections aren't necessarily meaningful connections. And he really talks about the benefits of solitude, which a lot of people sometimes confuse with loneliness. Like if I'm by myself, I might feel lonely, but solitude is different in that it's a choice. And he talks about how we all need to have those moments where we kind of break away from the noise of the world around us and really embrace our solitude, because solitude is the way that you really find answers at times, or the way that you can really listen to your own voice. I know for myself, like I'll be in a situation where I'll have a bunch of different people saying different things to me about what they would do or their opinions, and I get overwhelmed. I'm just somebody who tends to kind of shut down and I don't know what to think anymore because I'm being told by so many people around me, however well-intentioned those opinions might be. But oftentimes I find like I don't know what I think about something because I haven't been given the space, or haven't given myself the space to think about it. And that's what he's sort of saying is the real benefit of solitude, is you really get to know yourself when you allow yourself moments of solitude and allow yourself just to sort of be within who you are in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Many people, maybe myself, maybe not, I won't reveal too much, might say, oh, solitude, so just me and my phone. That's obviously not what that means. What is his suggestion for actual solitude?
So solitude is removing yourself in some way. It's you know, and this sounds cliche, but one of the things he recommends is going for a walk in the natural woods, like in the natural world. It's something that I don't do enough of, but he says, you know, you realize when you step into that environment, you're a very small piece of a much larger system. And you know, your ego becomes in check. And that downtime is not checking your phone. It's not shopping online or whatever. It's truly giving yourself the space to do something that's truly something that you find enjoyable and not necessarily shareable. In other words, if you are out and you take a beautiful picture of a sunset, he mentions at one point, don't feel the need that you have to share that photo. That's just for you. So I think we also fall into the trap, and I do myself, hand raised, of feeling like I have to share pieces of my life in order to get likes or to get people to click on that little heart button, or I don't know, there's lots and lots of psychology around this. But there's also something to be said about having those special moments and not sharing them with anyone but yourself, just sort of being having that for you.
Well, you're raising this issue, whether you want to or not, about this amazing, insane contradiction that exists right now. We're more connected than we've ever been, and we also have this epidemic of loneliness mm-hmm. that is happening. How does Michael Harris address that? This what seems like a huge contradiction.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the meaningful connection part that's missing, right? That we are sharing our lives with people we may never meet, you know, and it's very easy to communicate. I mean, one thing that comes up in some of the other books that I am discussing as well is the loss of that human connection, that face-to-face engagement. Even as you and I are talking here today, it's probably a different experience than if we were online, or, you know, if we were texting one another. And that's something that I think we sometimes lose touch with, is the humanity of our own lives, and that we're not all just screens and, you know, fingertips for texting. He talks a little bit in one of the chapters about letter writing and the art of letter writing and how that's kind of gone by the wayside in many ways, but how writing letters to people engages your entire hand. It's not your fingertips. It causes you to be thoughtful about your words. It's more of an expression of who you are. It's the physicality, I guess, of writing sometimes and writing letters that helps us reconnect maybe in a deeper way with our emotions or how we're feeling, which you can't necessarily get with your phone, and you can't get with your email or any of those other things.
Tell me about the next book on your list.
So the next book is called Do Nothing: How to Break Away from Overworking, Overdoing, and Underliving, by journalist and speaker and author Celeste Headlee. And this is, you know, her book really dives into this need to be productive. And we judge our days by how efficient we are, but not necessarily how fulfilling they are. Mm. So her book is sort of talks about, you know, the appreciation for idleness, not so much for solitude, but for idleness. And when she says idleness, you know, she says, I'm not trying to confuse this with laziness. That's not what I'm saying. It's more that idleness is inactivity, but it's non-productive activity, if that makes sense. So it's you saying
mindful doing of nothing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Without necessarily feeling like you have to accomplish something by the end of this period of time, that it's more just you being comfortable with doing nothing. For the sake of doing nothing.
And for many of us, that's a muscle that we would have to work on, right?
Yeah.
Okay, 4 minutes of nothing now. I better start doing something.
And it feeds into that idea too. And she gets into this as well. And I mentioned it before about the busyness of our lives and how that feeds into a sense of importance. You know, I don't have a free moment in my day because I am scheduled. And that sends a message, I think, of importance, of how busy, how many people need me. If I'm in meetings all day, clearly my opinion matters. When you don't have that super scheduling or that busyness in your life, I think sometimes there's that feeling like I'm not important or my opinions aren't valuable. So I think that's kind of a catch sometimes with people where the busier they are, the more important they feel, which feeds the ego. But sometimes the emptier you feel because you're not taking any time for yourself.
Let me ask you the flip of that. I'm thinking about cities, big cities that attract, lots of ambitious people. So hustle is the norm. That's business as usual. What does she say that we're missing as a result of that?
Well, I think mainly it's just that we feel that we're missing a sense of the connection that you would think that in a city center, you know, like a large urban center, that you would have that sense of connection more to one another because you're surrounded by people literally every day. But it is sometimes the more that you are around other people, the more isolated you can feel and the lonelier you can feel because I can go through the course of my day, not every day, but I can go through the course of even my commute to work being surrounded by people but never having a single interaction with any of them either. And the other day I watched as two strangers struck up a conversation on the subway. And it reminded me sometimes of how – and I eavesdrop because that's what you're supposed to do when strangers are talking on the subways, to listen to them. But it was a very innocent – and they got into like what their jobs were and what they did and what they did in their spare time. And I just thought, when was the last time that I engaged with a stranger? Like when was the last time I just started to make small talk with somebody? And it's been a long, long time. I think it's that – you don't know who necessarily you're talking to. You don't always know if the conversation's welcome. Like if the other person wants to talk, you don't always – you're not able to gauge that. But at the same time, if someone were to strike up small talk with me, I don't think I would mind. I would maybe be on high alert a little bit at the beginning. But eventually you would, you know, kind of ease into it a little bit if you saw that they weren't trying to find out anything. I think we're also suspicious of one another at the end of the day, which isn't a great way to be either.
Well, let's talk about the final book that you brought today.
So the last book is called Bread Therapy, The Mindful Art of Baking Bread. So it's written by a woman named Pauline Beaumont. She's a therapist who's based out of the UK who also bakes bread. So it's part recipe book, sort of part self-help book. And basically she says, you know, look, our lives are so busy and all the more reason to take on activities that slow us down and reconnect us to our physicality. So she says, you know, look, by making our own bread, it grounds us. It gives us a soothing experience. And she says there's something sort of miraculous, if you will, about combining flour and water and yeast, and then you create a loaf. And I will say there's something about yeast that when you come downstairs, like you put a ball of dough in a bowl and you put a tea towel on it or whatever, and you walk away and you come back an hour later and it's risen twice as to the size. It's like it makes you feel like you've accomplished something,
sure,
even though you haven't really done anything. The yeast has been doing all the work, right? But basically she's saying like when you are in touch with your physicality, it creates more moments of mindfulness. And if I'm focusing on making a loaf of bread and I'm focusing on the kneading and the proper mixing, my mind isn't whirling around with a bunch of negative thoughts or this person said this to me at work today or how do I interpret this or what do I need to do tomorrow? It forces you to kind of be in that moment, which I think is really what she's getting at, is it doesn't have to be bread. It could be anything really, but giving yourself some sort of physical activity that makes you focus on that activity and it stops your head from spiraling around.
First of all, I'm a big lover of bread. So okay. I'm really into this book and this whole theory here. But I'm also a big believer in, you know, I don't write daily. I struggle to sit down and write, specifically comedy. You know, just like look at a chair and be like, hey, what's funny about that chair? Nothing comes to me.
Yeah.
But it's in these moments, baking bread, cooking something I've cooked 100 times, vacuuming, snow shoveling, that my mind clears. And that's when the material sort of just appears in my head. That, So I see the value of this definitely.
And that's the thing with solitude too. I mean, to go back to the first book by Michael Harris, I mean, when you write, you're not surrounded by a bunch of people. It's pretty much just you and your laptop or a pad of paper or whatever. And that's how you need that solitude in order to be creative. That's when you are able to tap into your own voice and what, you know, how you want to write and what are the subjects you want to write about. And that's the other benefit of solitude and slowing down and the physicality, is that it really does put you in touch with yourself in a way that we don't always have that opportunity in our day-to-day lives.
You are a hands-on guy, from what I've heard on this very show. You like to try things before you recommend them. How did you do with bread therapy?
Well, okay, so I made a loaf of bread on Sunday, and it was very relaxing. I found it very therapeutic. The bread, it was made with spelt flour and some seeds. The bread could have gotten a little bit higher. It was a little dry for my taste, but that's okay. I made it, and that's the important thing. It gave me a good afternoon of focused attention, took my mind off of anything that might have been bothering me that afternoon, and I walked away with a loaf of bread. Now, she also talks about the connection that you have with baking, right? That it's something that you share with people, and it's a way to sort of express, you know, that you care about others by giving them your baking. And so I was going to make you a loaf, but I wasn't sure exactly how the loaf was going to, you know, over a couple of days, if the loaf was going to stay fresh. So I found another recipe that is very special to me. And I brought some in for you today. And I'm hoping that you see this as an act of caring at the end of the day.
In the entire time we have been talking, Brian, I've been eyeing that package in front of you, hoping that this would be the exact moment we come to. So, of course, I'm very excited. And I don't even need to try the bread. The excitement is overwhelming already, but I will try the bread, obviously. You put your hard work into it, and I'm sure I'll love it.
Well, this isn't – just so you know, though, this isn't like a loaf of bread from the book. This is a different recipe. So I got this recipe a few years ago from a 96-year-old woman named Mia, and she thought I might enjoy the recipe. And I thought this really worked in our – as part of our conversation, because the recipe for this bread has a few surprises and curveballs in it, not unlike life itself. So what I have made for you today is pork and beans bread. And I'm telling you right now, it has a can of beans that you puree and you mix it in. It's got like cinnamon and other things. And even though it's called pork and beans bread, I didn't use the pork and beans variety of beans, because when I was a kid, I was always traumatized when my mom would serve pork and beans and there'd be that cube of pork fat that just was grossed me out. It was this sort of congealed texture. So I don't do pork and beans. So this is made with regular Heinz non-pork beans. And to circle back to things, if you're looking for solitude, maybe you can invite friends over for a slice of pork and beans bread, and they might decide they're going to leave you alone, you know? And the other thing is that, you know, listen, because of the fiber content, if you're ever dealing with writer's block, maybe a slice a day could help kind of keep the creativity moving. So pork and beans bread for the win.
Well, definitely the win. Thank you so much, Brian.
You're welcome.
It's very nice.
Enjoy. I hope you like it.
I love the smell of it. I love the presentation and the parchment paper tied with twine. Brian Francis, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me today.
Brian is the author, most recently, of the memoir Missed Connections, and the books he was talking about today are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter.
Hello, my name is Leanne Hoffman. I am a songwriter, a writer, a poet, and a visual artist living in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I get my influence from a lot of different artists. I would say my music is mostly pop music. I am currently rereading one of my favorite books, The Solace of Open Spaces by Gretel Ehrlich. It's a memoir written about Ehrlich's time living and working at a ranch in Wyoming. It takes place shortly after her partner's death. The book talks about the people and the animals and the land, and the relationship that Ehrlich forms with space and solace. I really love this book because Gretel finds the beauty and the security in dark aspects of life. She draws a parallel between the Wyoming isolation and the isolation that we can feel in ourselves. And it paints a really beautiful picture of what it feels like to grieve. She shows us through the exploration of the space in Wyoming, how we can explore spaces within ourselves, spaces that we might perceive to be empty. And I think it's a really beautiful reminder that there's always ways to keep finding yourself, even if you feel like you're lost.
Dame Pallera grew up with a private investigator father, and she is desperate to leave that life behind, but fate has another idea in store for her. Dame Pallera is the protagonist of a new mystery series from Guelph writer Greg Rhino. The first book in the series is Who by Fire, and here's Greg Rhino to tell us more.
I'm a high school teacher, and I was working with a woman a few years back who was complaining about the fact that she had to fill in for her husband at work. And I was like, what does your husband do? And she said, he's a private investigator. And it was very striking to me that this was something she wasn't looking forward to. It seemed very exciting to me. And that I thought the idea of not only being sort of a replacement private investigator, like a substitute private investigator, but also a reluctant one was really interesting. So I wanted to play with that idea. I don't think there's one person that Dame Pallera is based on. But she is, I suppose, an amalgam of all the really smart, strong women that are in my life. My first book was so based on myself that I wanted to write a character that was very different from me. And so that was one of the reasons I wanted to write about a detective, because I'm just not that smart, and I wanted to pick someone who I thought was smart and strong and competent. And so I tried to pull all those qualities in from all the smart, strong, and competent women that I know and put them into this character. Dame's relationship with her father it's a relationship that changes. We see Dame in present day, and we see Dame in the past. And in the past, Dame was sort of reluctantly her father's sidekick. Her father is sort of this renowned private investigator, and she essentially would have to go on cases with him, and she picked up all these different skills that he has. In the present day, Dame is essentially caring for her father. Her father's had a stroke. He is no longer able to speak very coherently, and she looks after him, and he can no longer sort of do the things that he used to do. I've always liked mysteries, but my first book was coming-of-age literary fiction, and I think one of the joys of literary fiction is that there are no rules, right? You can really do whatever you want, and I think one of the challenges of writing a detective novel is that there are rules, and if you break the rules, people want to know why you broke those rules. There's a lot of really great literary writers who play with detective fiction. Authors who are playing with the genre because they want to say something new with it. And I don't know if I'm saying something all that new with Who by Fire, but I like the challenge of it. I was a drummer. I still am a drummer, but I was a drummer in a touring rock band for a number of years. And I was always interested in writing, but I'd never really given it the time. And when my partner got pregnant, I thought, well, I don't know if I'm ever going to have the time to write a book, so I might as well get started. And what I've found is that it was a lot easier to write while the baby was sleeping than it was to play the drums. So that is sort of why I made that switch from playing music to writing books. I wrote this book as part of my MFA thesis. There was a real learning curve with writing detective fiction. I really sort of barreled into it, as was sort of expected. I think what I've learned is what I should have been doing all along is working backwards, and I wasn't. I was sort of working forwards. So now that I'm working on the sequel to this novel, I've actually started working backwards and changed my approach.
That was Greg Rhino talking about his novel, Who by Fire. It's the first in a new mystery series featuring the reluctant sleuth, Dame Pallera. We'll be back after these messages.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm David A. Robertson. I'm the author of The Kodiaks, and you're listening to The Next Chapter on CBC Radio 1.
Don McDonald grew up in Whitehorse in a cabin down a dirt road with no electricity and no running water. She compares it to living in the 1800s, and her poetry collection, Northerny, is a fresh and unsentimental take on growing up and living in the North. Our contributor, Ryan B. Patrick, spoke with Dawn about Northerny.
Dawn, hello. Welcome to The Next Chapter.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So it's so great to connect, so great to chat about this poetry collection. It's a mix of poetry and some prose as well. Maybe you can kind of set the stage in terms of what do you remember most about living life off the grid?
Now, I don't want to oversell the situation. We weren't in the absolute middle of nowhere where you can't get to it by any means. We were about, at the time, I would say 45-minute drive out of Whitehorse.
Okay.
Off the grid by a little bit of a distance, that no electricity, not connected to the main electrical grid. We did have a system of 12-volt batteries that we used for some things. We did have a diesel generator that you could fire up occasionally. You just can't afford to run it that often. So, you know, you've got this kind of cobbled together setup to make life possible in that situation.
Mm.
You know, one of the things that I really remember about that situation, though, was being a kid and, you know, trying to do your schoolwork in a situation like that. So, for example, I had a solar-powered calculator that was difficult to get it to work with a kerosene lamp. I would have to kind of hold it up to the lamp, and if you set it down, you'd lose your calculation midway through. I also had a math textbook that I stuck under my bed one day, and when I went to get it, it was frozen to the wall because there was frost on the inside of the wall, just from how cold it could be sometimes in that house. So those are some of the types of things that would happen.
I've seen that you've mentioned that your parents saw it as an adventure living in the North or the Yukon. Is that how you saw it?
Well, it's a bit different when you're growing up. And that's one of the things that I think I come at from a couple different angles in my collection. There's an aspect to the collection that's those poems that are about that life out there. But there's an aspect that's really about the concept of story and how story can sometimes maybe get in the way of understanding what's really happening or what's the real life. And I say that because as kids growing up, you know, some of the adults are there on an adventure, but kids aren't on an adventure. We're just living our lives. And we may not really recognize until quite a bit later that we're sort of inside of a story that we didn't know about, that we've got almost these live reenactors who are trying to live as if they're in The Call of the Wild by Jack London, or as if they're in some sort of Robert Service poem. But you're not born having read those things. And so it's only over time that you start to feel this strange sort of secondary consciousness of what's been going on around you and what's the nature of the reality you've been living in.
So that brings us nicely to your new book. It's called Northerny. It's kind of poetry, some short prose, and it's a very powerful and poetic look at life in the North. How did this idea for the collection come to you?
You know, it's interesting. I think I really resisted writing something that's about the North. And I think that's common for people from the North, that we see a lot of the art that's presented as being Northerny. And sometimes we find it quite boring or it's hard for us to relate to. And that's because it's often coming from that Southern perspective of what seems exciting to someone who's just arrived in the North. You know, when they come in and see the Northern Lights for the first time and it's so amazing and they have some kind of journey of self-discovery. So I think I really resisted that for a long time. But over time, I started to see how, as I was writing, the natural world just kept coming up in my poetry. animals, birds, weather, landscape, that stuff is there because it's just so deep inside of who you are. And so I started watching how that was coming out and thinking, well, I think I do have a story to tell, but it's almost a different take or a flip on that main story about the North. It's how does that look coming from the inside, seeing what it looks like from the outside and trying to merge those two together.
So I want to take a quick step back and talk about your background as well. Like, you took math and physics courses in university, and you actually went to your scholarship interview wearing shoes that you had found at the dump. What was your North Star, so to speak, in terms of working towards academic success?
Well, first of all, oh my God, those were my best shoes by far. And yes, scrounging at the dump is something that you just never stop doing if you grew up that way. I'm always still scrounging. But yeah, so growing up where I did, I don't know, I got fixated on physics at a certain point. I had read a book called The Dancing Woolly Masters by Gary Zukav, which is a very mystical take on physics. Mm. I grew up in a bit of a, you know, a mystical milieu, kind of a counterculture hippie thing that was happening up here at the time. And so I was very taken by that. And I think I had the two parallel tracks inside of me of physics and poetry, with sort of grandiose ideas of somehow getting at some deeper understanding of what's happening in the universe, like what's really going on. And I felt that if I had a shot at going to university, that physics was the thing I ought to do, because that would be almost impossible to learn on my own. So if I had one shot at some kind of mentorship or scholarship, I should do the hard thing. And the hard thing was physics. That said, I had a pretty sketchy understanding of what it would be like to actually be a physicist and work in that field, which became apparent when I started my master's degree. I am a grad school dropout. And once I started my master's, it became obvious to me that it was not really what I had imagined. What I had imagined was based on mostly some old science fiction novels that I had read. And I think the job description I was looking for was mad scientist.
So the reason I asked you that question, because is there a connection between math and poetry? Like, how does your knowledge of like applied mathematics and concepts such as infinite series, does that shape or inform the poetry in this book in some shape or form?
You know, I think it does, but it comes in sideways, the same as I found the natural world coming in sideways. You know, I did think about it at the time as a physics student, that I still had those goals of writing something. I wasn't sure what. And I thought, well, if I study physics and then write something, I'll have a different perspective than someone who studies English and then writes something. And I think it does come up. So in my collection, there's numbered sections through the collection, and the first one is numbered zero, the zeroth section. That's a little bit of a math and physics joke. There is a zeroth law of thermodynamics, which was introduced after the first three laws, and was, instead of being numbered four, was numbered zero. The first poem in the collection that's in that zeroth section sits by itself and is about an egg. So there's a little bit of some joking or some resonance around the zero, the origin, the egg. There's definitely, I think, some other math and physics references that you'll find if you read through.
Mm. And I did read through. And the poems in this collection, Dawn, they radiate such vibrant energy, like vibes of reflection, of agency. There's a poem called A Boring Poem, and it explores how, like you mentioned, you didn't want to dwell in terms of talking about the North, in terms of Northern Lights or folk songs or sled dogs, but you wanted to talk about the people who migrate to the North. Can you kind of explain why you wanted to make that the focus?
Sure. You know, I think those stories of people who migrate to the North are super important. I don't want to take anything away from that. We've got some amazing adventurers that have come to the North. One of my close friends, his father climbed the seven highest peaks in the world and at one point operated an airline to Antarctica. We've got amazing adventurers up here. Those are incredible stories. But I just wanted to tell, I guess, the other story of being the children of adventurers who've grown up in this place. And, you know, there is a very dark aspect to the North. There is a lot of violence. There's a lot of addictions. There's a lot of those kind of issues that I think you really see when you live a whole life here, that you may not see when you come in from outside, particularly those who are maybe coming in for a government job or some kind of, you know, advantageous situation. There's just a side you're never going to know in the same way.
Mm. So you center yourself in this book, Dawn. You mentioned that you're just, quote, just some white chick who grew up in this place. But you also mention and acknowledge First Nations and Indigenous peoples such as the Carcross Tagish First Nation, White River First Nation, Selkirk First Nation. Why was it important to acknowledge Indigenous communities?
Well, I do want to acknowledge the poems in the collection were written on the lands of the Tanquachin Council, the Kwanlundun First Nation, Carcross Tagish First Nation, and also Champagne and Ajak First Nations and Kluwani First Nation. Those are the areas where I grew up and where I live now and where I've spent some time during the writing of the collection. You know, the Yukon's an amazing place. I grew up here during the time of active land claims negotiations and the building of the Umbrella Final Agreement, which set the stage for self-government among First Nations in the Yukon. The Yukon is really done amazing things there, but we have such a long ways to go on reconciliation. It's difficult, I think, for me as a white chick. These are not my stories to tell. So there's a lot of aspects of one's own life, I think, where we have to be so careful about how we tell a story and whose story are we telling. And there's so much that just isn't really mine to put forward, but it is so important to acknowledge what is happening here and who are the people here and who are the people who have been here since time immemorial.
So Dawn, I think it's time we hear you read a poem. How about Only Genius Can Solve This Puzzle, which is on page 37.
Sure. Now, this is a poem that is perhaps less directly about the North. This is more about language and reality and how those things connect. Only genius can solve this puzzle. How many harps in harpsichord? Depends if the H's are identical and the R's. When I say, I love you, is that the same as saying, I love you? Or, I love you? The sounds between the sounds are ours. Puns are Cohen's country cousins. A tiny breath disrupts the dust, makes jump just these few fond particles. Brownie and bumper cars. It doesn't take much. The breath that says anything, anything at all.
That was Dawn McDonald reading the poem Only Genius Can Solve This Puzzle from her poetry collection called Northerny. In terms of time and place and inspiration, like what inspires you to write poetry essentially?
You know, such a tough question. I carry a notebook around with me. Thoughts flit through your head. I try to get some of them down and then spend some time wrestling with them on the back end to turn them into, you know, a poem that functions a bit better as a poem. I don't know if we know why we do the things we do. I think some of this is just bubbles up and this is the form in which it comes.
Mm. There's a poem in the collection, Dawn, named At Hidden Lakes, and it starts with the lines, the pain in our bones brings the animals out. Now our emotions ease into animal time. So what does that poem, and by extension the whole collection, say about pain and healing?
You know, that poem is speaking a bit about aging. So it's taken me quite a while to bring out my first collection. I'm almost 50. My husband and I have a little lake nearby that we sometimes go to visit, and there's been beavers in the lake, muskrats in the lake, and we would spend time sitting by the lake, and we would see that the beavers would over time become pretty friendly to us. They would come out and swim near us, let us make eye contact with one another. And we talked about how as we get older, we are less of a threat in the way that we move through the woods, that some of the animals can see that we're slow, that we're not moving as fast as we did, and that it's a bit safer to engage with us as the creatures that we are. You know, pain is such a reality in all of our lives, and it's such a reality in the North. I had alluded to the high levels of violence and addictions in the North, really messy lives that people live here. But I think there is so much beauty without having to always clean up the mess. I'm really drawn towards art that's not so clean and not so polished, and that shows us some of those realities of things.
I like that. And by extension, your poetry looks at life in Yukon unvarnished and authentic. Fundamentally, what should people not from the North know about it?
You know, I struggle with that word authentic because there's so many realities, and this is just one of them. I think people not from the North should know that it's beautiful here. It's a mess. If you come up here, you're not our savior. If you come up here, in some sense, you're taking a job from someone here who probably could do it with appropriate, you know, training and development. We're really prone to bringing people in to do jobs instead of hiring from our own people. So, you know, to know that you're having an opportunity to connect with an incredible landscape with some really interesting people. It's your story, but it isn't just your story. It's the story of the people who are here. It's the story of the First Nations. It's the story of this land. And you are welcome here. We'll probably, you know, have a good time together. But it's a complicated story.
Dawn, thank you so much for this book and for the chat.
Thank you, Ryan.
That was our contributor, Ryan B. Patrick, in conversation with Dawn McDonald about her poetry collection, Northerny. And for the poets out there, the CBC Poetry Prize is currently accepting submissions. You could win $6,000, a writing residency, and have your work published. Head to cbcbooks.ca for all the details. Nathan Maharaj has always been a science lover, and he loves books too. So when those two things come together, all the better. In his day job, Nathan lives and breathes books. He's the director of content marketing at Rakuten Kobo, and he's a lifelong bookseller. Nathan joins me now to tell us about three books on popular science that have been standouts for him. Hello, Nathan. Welcome to the next chapter.
Hello, Ollie. It's delightful to be here.
Tell me when this love of science started for you. And I'm asking from a selfish perspective because maybe I can impart this to my own children as well, depending on how this went for you.
Yeah, it was. I think it's always been there from when I was very little. My mother tells a story of me haranguing at, I think, the age of five, the whoever was the director of vertebrate paleontology at the Royal Ontario Museum, because all of the dinosaur displays were standing fully upright with their tails dragging, and research, you know, prior to in the mid 80s, you know, even as a kid, there was no internet. I somehow had figured out, no, we have no record of them dragging their tails. So all of these mountings are wrong.
Said, I object.
I object. Yeah. You have it's. I was ready for the internet. When the internet came along, it was like, someone will be wrong and you can argue with them. It was all for me. But yeah, science has always been there. And it was, yeah, dinosaurs started it. But I mean, it's once you start asking questions, they never stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've already created this terrific segue, so let's start talking about these books. What's the first book you wanted to tell us about today?
Well, I want to talk about Rise of the Necrofauna, The Science, Ethics, and Risks of De-Extinction by Britt Ray. And we're going to notice that subtitles are doing a lot of work for these books.
I bet. Were you familiar with the word necrofauna before?
I wasn't.
Okay, so tell me what drew you to this book.
Well, it was the word itself was very intriguing. I think I immediately knew what it meant. I knew that it was things that are dead coming back to life, and so I was wondering, is this book going to tell me about like voodoo revitalization? It's not. It's actually about it's about de-extinction, and it explores through the writer Britt Ray, who's a science communicator and scholar, the efforts made in a variety of ways to bring species back. It's the Jurassic Park thing. Mm. She gets right into, okay, would it be possible and should we do it? And there is a book-length discussion on those topics.
You mentioned Jurassic Park, which was the first thing that popped into my mind. So it sounds like something from science fiction or fantasy or film. Is it something we should be pursuing as a species?
So the big spoiler is, no, it's a terrible idea. But what makes the book fascinating is it's a terrible idea in a bunch of different ways. And along the way of learning why it's a bad idea, we learn a bunch of other stuff. Like, for instance, there are breeding projects going on in Europe where some eccentric people with money and land think they might bring back the aurochs, which is this massive bovine animal, this big cow that's sort of the granddaddy of all of our cows. And its DNA is scattered throughout the genome of domestic bovines now. And if each cow passes a little bit of aurochs DNA forward, several generations forward, maybe we got an aurochs, which is this bison-sized cow.
What will the aurochs burger taste like, Nathan?
Well, so I imagine there's a marketing angle in this insofar as it would be probably paleo approved.
Okay, good. All right. You've already started the marketing campaign. Incredible. We're generations away, but you're ahead of the – just like you were at age five, you're ahead of the curve again. Tell us about the next book on your list.
The next book is by the theoretical physicist Chanda Prescod Weinstein, and it's called The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space-Time, and Dreams Deferred.
Okay, very interesting. So this is a woman in science story, from what I understand?
Yes. Chanda Prescod Weinstein is a young theoretical cosmologist, particle cosmologist is her official title. She is one of like 50-something black women to have ever earned a doctorate in physics in the United States. So she shares a very human perspective of what the practice and study of science is.
It'll surprise nobody to find out that I don't really know what a particle cosmologist is. What is particle cosmology?
To be honest, I'm not sure I know. But what I do gather from the book is she makes very clear she's a theoretical physicist. So she can work on a blackboard and paper and computers. Telescopes are not part of her world. Data found through observation is.
The answer you just gave me is actually quite interesting because it shows that you can be open to something, interested in something, and not get like a final total answer about it and still have enjoyed the experience of, you know, learning as much as you could about it.
Well, this is what I think intimidates people about science is that they think if they don't understand the whole thing, that they've understood none of it. And that's tragic because science is about learning as much as you can and coming back for more if that's where your mind goes. And that's how I approach it. I don't have to come out of this book or any of these books as an expert. I just have to be interested. I just have to be curious about what the next question is. I don't love cosmology. That's not my go-to. I like animals. I will read to learn about biology and bodies and evolution. To get me into space stuff, I need another angle. And this book has that angle where she talks about what it was like to come up through grad school. This isn't just these people were racist to me and those people were sexist to me. She talks about how we even come up with names for things like dark matter. It's in the subtitle. She spends a whole chapter on it. The French word for it is actually matière obscure, which just means stuff that's hard to see. But when we bring it into English, for some reason we say dark matter, which is completely inaccurate because a physicist would know darkness means the absence of photons, and that's not our problem with dark matter. Our problem with dark matter is we just can't perceive it. It's got nothing to do with light. It's got nothing to do with vision. And so she talks about things like this, these little places where we have a tolerance, where the whole discipline makes a tolerance for an inaccuracy. And frequently we see those inaccuracies have something to do with marginalized people, where there's a tie of like, well, we don't care. We call a lot of things dark and we don't really think too much about it. And the book has that human angle that I think would really pull someone through.
All right. So the last book you wanted to talk about today.
The last book is The Last Days of the Dinosaurs, An Asteroid, Extinction, and the Beginning of Our World by Riley Black.
How perfect, as dinosaurs were the beginning of your world back when you were a young five-year-old, Nathan.
Yeah, they absolutely were. This book does what I think every dino nerd has wanted for the longest time. And it came out in 2021, which is a big year for us, for my people of dino nerds. It was the year that Apple TV Plus's Prehistoric Planet came out, in which we got a nature documentary series narrated by David Attenborough as if we were just watching these animals in the wild. At the same time, just a couple months before that, this book came out and it was essentially that as well, except it was framed around the extinction event, that the end of the Cretaceous that made life very hard on Earth for a lot of animals, the dinosaurs being dominant. It wiped out all of them except the ones that could get, you know, nutrition from seeds because they had beaks, and they're still around today.
Mm. When one goes to your Twitter / X page, dinosaurs is the first thing they see. It's your cover photo. You've told me you've been interested from the beginning. What did you learn about dinosaurs from this book that you didn't already know?
What I learned was it's almost not a question of the learning, but more about the consideration, the being alongside and the immersion in ecosystems. This book is framed in a really interesting way. The first chapter is moments before asteroid impact, We're in Alberta. Mm. We're next to the rotting corpse of a majestic but well past its prime Triceratops. He's a bull. He's about the size of a, you know, small SUV. And the ecosystem around it is coming to eat him. And the next chapter is the day after. And the chapter after that is a month after. And it goes on until the 10th chapter is a million years later. What is the world like when dinosaurs are ancient history, but we are still 65 million years in the future? So it's a really fascinating way of looking at the prehistoric timeline.
Would you say that was your biggest takeaway from this book, this way of looking at dinosaurs that you hadn't done previously?
Yeah, as beings in ecosystems, as animals in nature, I think that's a thing we miss a lot about the slavering jaws and the saliva and the differential timeline. I mean, the thing that I always tell people when I'm trying to get across, like, no, these were animals and they lived on our planet and it was incredible, is the last Tyrannosaurus rex died 66 million years ago. When it died, the last Stegosaurus, as far as we can tell from the fossil record, had died 85 million years ago. So we take our dinosaur toys and we make them all play together, but the timeline is so long that we are closer to a Tyrannosaurus rex in chronology than that T-Rex was to a Stegosaurus. So it is like the only sensible reaction is mind-boggling wonder.
I mean, I am both in wonder and my mind is boggled from this conversation. I do want to ask you one last question. To readers who might say to you that they don't seek out science reading or may think that it's boring or tough to get through, what would you say to them?
I would say, if that's been your experience, then you're right. As a bookseller, I'm never going to tell a reader that they're wrong. My position would be they haven't found the book yet. And they also maybe felt like they had to read the whole thing beginning to end, because as a fiction reader, that's what you do. I would tell that reader, you don't need to do that. Jump to a chapter that looks interesting, dip in and out, approach this book as you would approach a conversation with an interesting and an informed person. You don't have to necessarily take it at that speed. You have curiosity, you have interests, pursue that and let the book be a part of that.
Nathan, you've done both science and literature a great service today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ali.
Nathan Maharaj is a science lover and reader and the director of content marketing at Rakuten Kobo. The titles he recommended today are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. And that is it for today's program. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer with Lisa Matthews. And my thanks this week to Laura Antonelli, Trevor Carter, and to the CBC Books digital team. Coming up next week, I'll speak with Edmonton writer Connor Kerr about his new crime thriller, Prairie Edge. And Emily Austin will be here to talk true crime podcasts and balding men. The best type of men, some might say. Both are subjects in her new novel, Interesting Facts About Space. I'm Ali Hassan. Thanks for listening to The Next Chapter.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.